Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. This week we look to next year. After one of the most tumultuous global and market environments in living memory, through the lens of our popular Megatrends series. For veteran listeners of our show, our long-term trends may be familiar. We have developed these as one of our many macroeconomic overlays that can help steer our tactical asset allocation with an enduring view. Long-term trends are important, as they sit in the background, away from the noise of daily market movements, and serve as a reference point that can be used when uncertainty is higher than normal. And safe to say, 2020 is a year marred by uncertainty, and there is, unfortunately, little chance that the resumptions of normalcy will start on January 1st next year. Because of this, we thought it might be a great time to review exactly where our megatrends might fit into the post-COVID world as vaccines begin to take effect and economies start down the long road to recovery. Here to share his thoughts on how our megatrends will shape 2021 and beyond, and how they may be used in our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Good to have you on. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, we're only 100 subscribers away from 3,000 on YouTube, and we have the goal of hitting that 3,000 mark before the new year. So if you haven't already, subscribe and click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, and or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And we also ask if you could take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into the agenda for today. Going to kick off with exactly what is a long-term trend. So a little bit of background on our thoughts there. We'll then move into what are the seven key long-term trends that we'll be talking about today, how to use those in an investment framework, and then, of course, wrapping it all up, as we do every show, in how we use them and incorporate these into our portfolios here at Nucleus Wealth on a day-to-day basis. So, Damien, we'll kick off with the seven long-term trends, and kick off with perhaps how to use them and what they are.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I just want to preface that I guess this is the as I do each time I sort of run through these, is that these are your trends that you may not see on a day-to-day basis. They're sort of 20, 30, 50 year trends, and so and they'll be, you won't notice them as you start seeing recessions and booms and things like that sort of go on, that they sort of mask the trends from time to time. And so, but then when you sort of come out the other end of it and you look at sort of the longer term trends, you can quite clearly see. So let's say you're looking at, say, a good example is if you're trying to look at whether the level of the ocean is rising or falling, and let's say it's rising over a period of time, is you're not going to notice that on a day-to-day basis, because you're going to see that there's going to be high tides and low tides, and the moon will be in different places, and so you'll get king tides at some time of the year and extra low tides at the other times of the year, or the storm surges and things like that. So there's all these factors going on where from a day-to-day basis you might not be able to put your finger exactly and say that this is what's going on, but over that longer term trend, over a number of years, you can just clearly see that the tides are getting higher and higher or what have you. And that's how I think of these trends, is that, they're in your portfolio. Yes, there'll be storms and other things going on in your portfolio and day-to-day actions that you need to look out for, but keeping these in mind and that you've sort of, got your eye on that longer term prize and not losing track of it in all the short term noise.
Absolutely. And you mentioned there, so sea level's rising, and I guess we've got a chart up there on climate trend as well.
Yeah. Similar type of one. So basically they're just sort of showing that, this is that your red line is your longer term trend, but you can very clearly see that there's some shorter term trends in there. You can, and the year to year volatility is quite high. And so, but that relentless sort of upward trend in that, the temperature changes there is certainly more obvious in a longer term picture.
I'll just jump back a slide here. We've got the key long-term trends. Obviously, we'll cover off on our ones in a moment. But I guess from an investment standpoint, how is this sort of relevant? Is this sort of where does it sort of plug into the way that you look at things, or the way you should look at things?
Yeah, sure. I guess what it means for me is it's about the stocks that we're going to sit in our portfolio and hold for a very long time, or okay. The asset allocations that we're putting them in with that goal to hold it for a long time, versus other ones where they may not match our longer term trends, but they're particularly cheap, or there's market circumstances that make them as an attractive investment for at that point in time, or for a number of years even. But if we've got that in the back of our mind that it doesn't fit our trend, then we'll be looking for the chance to tip out of it and to move into sort of more assets that we're happier to hold for the longer term.
Mm, okay. All right. Very good. Thanks for that. We'll kick off with trend number one.
Yeah. So this one, the rising inequality is, has been, certainly in the papers and investment press for the last 10 years or so. But this has been a very, very long-term trend. It's come back to, I've got back here to the 70s. We can see the bottom 50%. This is the share of US income. It's not quite halved, but it's closing in on it over that time period. And it's worth noting that there's, this is a trend that doesn't look like reversing at the moment. Mm. So we've had the post the financial crisis, there was a bunch of protests that sort of went on about the 1% and sort of campouts in Wall Street and things like that, but they all fizzled out. There's potentially we might see a little bit more of that at the moment, but I guess everyone's pretty focused on the virus, and so maybe and it does look as if inequality has increased again with the virus, because a lot of the measures that are put in place are they're blunt measures, and unfortunately we don't have much of a choice, but it's sort of going, well, if a large proportion of the people need help and they need these stimulus checks and things like that, then there will also be stimulus checks ending up in the hands of people who don't need it, but it's very hard to allocate that out right correctly, and so that's where it goes. And also we've seen company profits have done relatively well so far. I mean they've fallen certainly, but relative as a share of the share of the economy, they've risen. And mm-hmm. so corporate profits generally tend to flow back to the richer people. And so very much the coronavirus is in my mind is going to make this worse. I would argue that the rise of sort of the populist politicians like Trump or Boris Johnson in the UK, there's been some others in other countries that haven't quite made it into power, but certainly starting to pick up significant votes. Is that a lot of the rise of that is this inequality where they know something's wrong, and if somebody stands up and says, I hear you, something is wrong, and I've got the solution for you, whether they do or not have the solution, it's an attractive message for voters. Mm. I'm expecting that the coronavirus will just accelerate this trend. The way it is at the moment, maybe there'll be a backlash, but for the moment, that rising inequality certainly seems to be a something that's happening. What does that mean in terms of investments? We look at for say some luxury goods and particularly some of the really high end stuff. I think some of the lower end luxury can be affected by middle class not being able to afford it, but some of the particularly high-end luxury goods have held up particularly well during the financial crisis. And that's one area where if you're expecting this to keep growing, then that's where you can expect that to happen. Mm-hmm. It's also a reason why we're a little bit more positive on the travel sector, assuming that the vaccine, one of the sort of many vaccines that are out there comes through and we move to the point where if you want to travel, you'll have your shot and off you go. Mm-hmm. Is that when you get lots of inequality, then rich people tend to want to travel a fair bit, and that's a so plays into that travel trend.
Yep. Okay. No, very good. All right. Well, look, we'll jump across to our next one there. Trend number two, baby boomers.
Baby boomers. Right. So. Yeah, so this is one that's reversing. So so that first one, inequality, is, you know, it's been a tailwind for, I don't know, 30, 40 years, maybe longer, and we're not expecting that to change. This next trend is one that is changing, though. So what I've got here is the dependency ratio, so number of people working versus the number of people who aren't working. And and so what we've seen is that dependency ratio, the number of people who depended on people who are working. Yeah, so that when it reached over 90% was that there was a lot of kids. So you could see that the children there were sort of, you know, 70% of the economy in the US back in the 1960s were under the working age. And then you had the older people at the bottom line where, so they were dependent as well. So 70-something percent of people were dependent because they were young, and then another 15%, 20% because they're old, and it sort of meant that you really didn't have very many workers at all driving the US economy. And so that was a long, 40-year trend where it just went down and down, and it's just more and more people working as the baby boomers aged and moved into the sort of the prime of their lives. And there's a, you know, for anyone who hasn't seen it, there's sort of some snake in the, sorry, some, they call it pig in the python type charts that sort of show where the baby boomers, had just been gradually moving through these demographics, and there were so many births following the Second World War that group of people has been quite a reliable investment trend in terms of saying, well, what do they need next? And what they need next is to retire, and some of them are already doing so. And you can see that on this graph, so this is looking forward, and I've circled where we are. But we've basically the last couple of years has been where it's flipped to rising again, and we're in the steep part of the curve now. We've got another 10 years of dependency rates falling or rising, depending on how you want to talk about this graph. But basically, there will be fewer workers out there for every retired person, and we haven't got there's sort of a falling child dependency as well. So we haven't got the birth rates coming through in the US, and this is a similar chart to what you get in Australia as well. Australia's got a little bit better growth, but not dissimilar.
And that's the whole problem, isn't it? Because, you know, you can put up with having a high dependency ratio as long as in the future it's stimulative to demand, and, you know, there's people buying houses and, you know, having kids and doing all the rest of it. But this is the turning into the inverse in the sense that there's little input going back into the economy with a rising age dependency. So
that's right.
where the demand's going to come from?
Yeah, exactly. When it's kids, you can see where it's the benefits. And the other thing as well, obviously, is that older people do tend to use a lot more health services, medical services. So you sort of got a growing group of people who are going to be demanding sort of more and more healthcare, and a shrinking pool of workers to supply it. Now, quite possibly, there's robotics and other stuff that'll help out, and there's a lot of driverless cars and other things. It's going to free up large portions of the population. So that may not, you know, it may not be a dire outcome, but it's certainly economically speaking, it's going to be you're not going to see the same type of growth. That's been this huge tailwind. Keep in two parts. What's the, you know, will people be able to find jobs in the future? Is one issue. Mm-hmm. And you know, these lines suggest yes, but the other part is, well, is there going to be a in terms of economic growth, is there going to be fewer people doing work for more people? And the answer to that is yes, which is
and this is essentially the commonplace across all the developed world. Yeah, like Japan, I know they're probably at the far end of the scale. Yeah,
Japan's worse. Europe's worse as well. So Japan's China, terrible. China's just turning. So China's if you look at the their graph is way steeper though. That's the thing, is that they've really benefited. So this the one child policy was beneficial to a certain stage, and you've sort of but
it's gone against them.
Yeah, it's about to start going against them, or it's just in the last few years has turned, because these things aren't exact, but yeah, in the last few years it's turned and it's going to start rising. The thing with it, because of the one child policy, and because there's very little immigration into China, it's going to get dramatically worse in China.
Yep.
And so they're about to move into a much steeper curve than what you've got in the US.
Yeah, right. Interesting. All right.
So,
good.
Yeah. So the message, though, is for 50 years, we've had this great tailwind, and it's about to turn into a headwind. And in some countries, it's going to be a very stiff headwind.
Okay. Sure thing.
And so from an investment perspective, what does that mean? It means
healthcare and travel.
Healthcare, yeah, travel to a certain extent. You know, I think you want to be a little bit careful as, it's travel for the next few years, you're fine. As you said, people are, you know, the average baby boomer rolling out at 60 and you know, wanting to travel.
Doing a big overseas holiday.
Yeah. But as they get a little bit older again, then that's going to, you know, that'll tail off as well as they start getting older and don't want to travel as much.
Can't. Yeah.
Exactly. So there is some healthcare side of it. There's certainly investment sides of that as well. So, you know, I'd even hesitate to say, well, I'd say that, you know, our strategy was not actually to chase the baby boomers as much because we do a lot of our investment stuff, you know, finding customers and generating them online. Ours was to say, well, as baby boomers and you know, future generations who really demand personal contact and want that sort of want a safety net and are prepared to pay for it, as that sort of gradually moves into younger investors, and that these people pass on their inheritance to the younger generations. Younger generations are going to be more willing to use the internet and build up trust with people and listen to blogs and podcasts and deal with people over Zoom and things like that to manage it for the benefit of being able to get more information and cheaper. You know, I think there's a transition part we're sort of betting on over the next sort of 10, 15 years. So there's, I guess, lots of different investment trends come off that. But keep in mind as well that these are long-term trends. They're not, you know, from year to year, you won't see it. It's that, you know, that inexorable change from demographics.
And there was this, talk sort of early days in February, March with these lockdowns that we might have had a COVID baby boom, but it appears that it's actually gone the other way.
Yeah, COVID baby bust, exactly.
Divorce boom rather than a baby boom.
But anyway. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there is a thought as well, at the early stages of this is saying, well, if this does really run rampant and just wipe out lots of people, then it might actually help some of the dependency ratio in that it generally does kill older people.
Good.
Yeah. But the levels that the levels aren't high enough. So, I mean, which is good. You know, I'm not saying that's bad.
It's a wonderful
outcome. But, even in the US where they're doing a pretty bad job of managing the whole coronavirus, it's going to make a limited difference to these dependency ratios.
Good one. All right, we'll jump across to trend number three: women in the workforce.
Yes, this is another sort of 50-year trend, and so I've sort of got two different charts on there. One is the left-hand ones. They're similar types of views, but slightly different definitions. But the one on the left is sort of the longer-term view, where you can see that, you know, women made up in the US 14% of the workforce in 1966 and are now over 50%. Their participation rate, the number of women working within the workforce.
That's right, yep.
Yeah, and then the other one is the number of female percentage of the workforce. And the issue is whether this is topping out. And it does appear to be doing so. In a few sort of the Scandinavian countries, the one on the right there, the top two is Finland and Sweden. So that does appear to have topped out and not be increasing anymore. The US has actually also been falling for the last few years in terms of the female percentage of the workforce. And Australia's so a little bit hard to see from this graph. I apologise, but it has sort of in the last 3 or 4 years as well seemed to have topped out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know, there's a few things coming from this. I guess one is to recognise this has been a big tailwind as well for economies. Is yep. You know, just more people working and that dependency ratio things we saw earlier. You know, some of those really high dependency ratios we saw back in the US where you sort of go, really, when 90% of people reliant upon 10% of people working? And it yeah. goes, well, you know, there's a husband who's the breadwinner and a wife who's at home with the, you know, five kids or six kids or whatever the yeah. average, you know, quite a number there. So there's that gives you
probably working harder than the husband, to be honest. But
that's
anyway.
Right. Yeah, well, that's exactly, but not in paid work. Yep. Actually, yeah. Shout out to my wife, obviously. so that you know, that's one worker to, you know, whatever it is, six or seven people. You throw in two sets of grandparents, and and you can easily see where you're getting that 90% ratio, yep. or you know, then you get great grandparents and other factors as well. So turning that into two people working obviously made a huge difference yep. just to economies. The there's this issue about saying, well, is there a natural limit in terms of you know, women without, I don't want to be going to come across as sexist or anything, but women do generally take a larger part of the caregiving and yeah. that's often a choice that's made between, you know, between partners. Yep. And there's a question about whether at certain economic levels, women are therefore happier to say, well, I'll work 3 days a week or 4 days a week or whatever it is, and they just don't want to work anymore. And so it's not a question of you know, if you gave extra childcare or you gave all these other factors, is if people are at a certain comfort level, then they'll choose not to work as much. So what is that? What's the coronavirus doing? Well, coronavirus has actually hit the female workforce relatively hard, in that the retailers in particular are dominated by women, and that's been mm-hmm. one of the area hardest hit by coronavirus sort of shutdowns. So there is a question about whether that's there's a little bit of a downtick in that. You know, I guess you're potentially there'll be more economic hardship. And especially if you see these, you know, that first trend we talk about, the inequality is still rising. So maybe you'll see a little bit of female labor force sort of tick up for necessity. But you know, that's not a good type of trend. That's a very limited type of trend, I think.
Something I was going to say, but and obviously it's very short term, but may have, you know, a fair impact into next year, is the, you know, like people working in the healthcare industry, nurses, etc. Predominantly, you know, female or otherwise, there's obviously, particularly over in the US, enormous demand for whether or not they actually want to work in the health system over there is probably another question.
Well, but the other issue is elective surgeries is where a lot of the money is in hospitals, and it's they've been very limited, and you know, particularly in places like the US where the virus is still running rampant. Is that you know, the precautionary medical things may not be being done. So it's basically saying, well, if we think there's a low chance you have you know, whatever disease, and here's a scan you could go and do to check it out. But if the hospitals are full with coronavirus patients, then maybe that scan doesn't get done for a few years or you know. So I think there's. There's positives and negatives to the healthcare industry, but it's certainly not a complete positive. Mm. Yeah. So as a long term trend, though, from an investment perspective, you know, I look upon this very much as it was a tailwind for sort of 40, 50 years. It's no longer a tailwind. I don't think it's going to be a headwind. Maybe it might be, you know, if we get some demographic changes, but I think at the moment it's worth just saying, well, it's gone from being a tailwind to basically a neutral in terms of the effect on yep. investments.
Yeah, very good. And just one last one I might throw in there as well is, the, you know, as a household unit, by having two incomes, you can, you know, in effect, if they're both stable, obviously, double the amount that you can borrow.
Absolutely.
Like home.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which ties us in nicely to our trend number four.
Yeah.
If you're number three.
Yeah, that's right. I've used an older chart on this one just because it's got a much longer history on it. I don't have the data easily accessible for this. Just because I wanted to show. So this is in Australia. Just showing the levels of private debt, and we've sort of plateaued out a little bit, but it has risen again from where that is. The public debt was very low. It's got a rocket under it at the moment, that public debt. But I guess what I really wanted to highlight, though, was that, you know, you look back at the, most of the 1900s, and private debt was well below 50%. And interest rates were pretty low in the earlier part of the century. So you're not as low as they are now, but they certainly weren't. There was the 20% interest rates. You know, we talk about in the 80s. Certainly weren't a factor. You know, back in the 1960s and early, you know, interest rates were low at that point in time. And so there's been this real debt push, which has been this major tailwind for economic growth, is when you spend the money you don't have, it brings forward demand and helps push the economy along. But you can't keep playing that trick. At a certain stage, the public side, we've spoken a lot about MMT and other factors, and so I guess the conclusion there is you probably can't keep playing that trick for a long time. but on the private side, it's much more difficult. And you just get to the point where people just don't want to take on more. You know, if you've got the average person out there with a $500 million mortgage or a $700,000 mortgage, and then saying to them, "Hey Tim, how would you like some more debt to go put an extension on or something like that?" People, even if they're not, if they can afford the interest payments, will start being a little bit concerned about never being able to pay the debt off ever, which is for some people it's a likelihood.
They need to put that in the loan application. You know, at the minimum rate, you'll have this paid off by. I think they do that for private credit, but I'm not sure if it's done for. You've got to work that out yourself on the on a home loan. So
yeah,
anyway,
yeah. But so So I guess what I'm flagging here is so this is one where we are getting another burst in this, but
yep.
It's probably not really what you want in terms of when you go through a. The debt's there to sort of cover the hole that's happened in the economy. So if there was sort of a bunch of extra debt that's going into productive uses, so a bunch of people starting businesses and
innovation,
building new things and generating returns on it, then you can see how that's beneficial. That'll generate a return that'll help pay down the debt. When it's just a matter of saying, people are bidding up existing housing stock to buy it from each other and taking out major loans to do so, then that's not a productive use of resources.
Yep. No.
And so and even worse, if it's a matter of saying, well, I've lost my job or there's an economic downturn and I needed to borrow this money to replace the income that I never got. And so 3 years later, so you started on a $100,000 job with $500,000 of mortgage, and then you lost your job, and 3 years later you get back another job at $100,000 or more, but now you've got a $600,000 mortgage. You're saying, well, you're no better off, and you're much worse off in terms of earning capacity and your the amount of debt you have. So the short message is, there's another leg up, but you're basically limiting how much further this thing can go, and we do think we're closing in on the levels for private debt that's going to start restricting demand. Well, I think we're already there.
Well, that's right. And, you know, and we've got a question actually that's popped in. I'll ask that one in a moment. But, well, obviously, you know, there's only so low that mortgage interest rates can go, isn't there? You know, a buddy of mine dropped me a message. He got a call from a bank today offering him high ones, one of the big four banks, offering him high ones on a mortgage refinance. I was thinking, geez, we're there already, are we? But there is a question actually from Nick. He's asked, where do you stand on the price of gold and real rates? You can maybe talk about the gold one a little bit later on, but can real rates go much higher without triggering defaults world over?
I don't think real rates can go particularly high until they trigger defaults, but I think that's why central banks won't let them go high. Yep. We'll just start seeing them bid down, and that's where you'll start getting, whether it's negative interest rates or you'll just be getting at least some very strange distortions in the curve, like the term funding facility in Australia or the TARP LTRO or something like that in Europe, where they're basically pumping out cheap debt to specific people in order to focus
cheap debt.
So what does that mean for the price of gold? Look, gold is in theory an investment asset which people will still value. And so it's basically if you treat it as a currency, which we often do in our analysis, and everyone's debasing their own currency by printing money and taking as much debt on as they can, then you do start seeing inflation, then gold should be a hedge for that, but it is reliant upon other people also believing that to be true. So people, it's sort of that part about if people believe gold will go up, then because it's an inflation hedge and inflation does start to come back, then it'll give you some benefit. I think there's also a part where Bitcoin is sort of recently, the sort of the argument whether Bitcoin's been, some people who would have bought gold have been buying Bitcoin instead. And so, I guess there's a valid argument in terms of if gold is a belief system and people decide that they'd like to start believing in Bitcoin instead, then there's issues for gold. And then the other part was, so let's do another podcast of someone talking about saying, well, gold's, you know, at least gold's not manipulated by central banks and governments and all these types of things like that. And the issue is it is. Central banks are some of the biggest holders of gold reserves globally. And so, the other thing to keep in mind as well, so we do have some gold holdings. So we're sort of mildly positive on the longer term outlook. We're positive on the long-term outlook for these reasons, but it is worth noting that if some central banks turned around and started selling their gold reserves, that would wipe out the gold market for years. And so
just on the scale, on the quantum that
they've just got dramatically higher reserves. So in the end, you know, all the gold is with central banks or with investors, the actual people using it for jewelry and for industrial uses is actually pretty small.
Right. Yep. Okay. One other question here, just because it's relating to debt, and then we can move on. Damien, do you see the increase in debt for fixed assets and very low increase of production? Are we looking at inflation of goods?
Yeah, this is, this is a million-dollar question. Look, I don't think so. I think for goods in particular, there's a pretty flat supply curve. In terms of saying I think China in particular and a number of other developing countries can produce a lot of goods at very cheap prices. And if the demand ticks up, then it's not like they let me step back for 1 second. In some commodities, like let's say oil, if we suddenly doubled our demand for oil overnight, the oil price would skyrocket because the demand takes a long time. The supply takes a long time to come on, and you know, is it there? It probably is, but there's going to have to be you're going to need a few years of high prices before people say, "Oh yeah, here's a well that is profitable at $100. I will actually go and drill that and pump it out." So there's some assets where you get extra demand and the price just skyrockets. I think with a lot of goods, that's not the case. they're relatively cheap and quick to produce, and that they can be scaled up. And so I think the inflation in goods, if we see it, is going to be quite short term. Mm-hmm. The other thing as well is goods are a shrinking part of the global economy, and especially developed countries. Yep. It's more and more services. Mm-hmm. So there's a big question over, can we see inflation in services? And usually you'd have to see
wage inflation
for that to happen. Yep. And high unemployment rates are not conducive to seeing wage inflation. And so for my part, I don't discount that we might see inflation in goods or services, but I don't think it's likely in either. The flip side is, houses and land is there is a short supply of, and some of that's
plenty of debt.
Having said that, I want to make clear that a lot of it is a choice, though. Like, Australia is a very, very big country, and even even states as small as Victoria are very, very big, relative to the population of the whole of Australia. The size of Victoria in Europe, you pack a lot more people in. So it's not a there's not actually really a land shortage so much as there is a shortage of land that you're allowed to build on. There's a choice we're making in there in terms of making sure that Australian house prices are high. So
Okay, very good. And thanks for your question, Damien, as well, on the chat. We'll jump across to company tax rates, another input from, we're talking about higher employment and higher wage prices. Well, company tax rates is another lever that can be used.
That's right. So I've got a long-term chart up there just showing over the last 40 years. So the worldwide average, weighted average is probably the one to focus on. Pretty close to 50% 40 years ago, and now we're below 30, and closing in on 25. So pretty much halved it. If you actually, I must admit, I've got another chart up there, and I actually haven't updated these numbers for a couple of years, so they probably haven't even got the Trump tax cuts in this. But basically, if you looked at what I mean by real is excluding inflation. Earnings per share growth over the last sort of 30, 40 years, it's been about 6%.
We've got 6% on the screen. The chart goes to 2020.
That's right.
Drop in the blue one.
Yeah. I guess if you break that up into what's actually been the what's been the growth in EPS versus the effect of the tax cuts. Then you get you basically get that the tax cuts have given you about a quarter of all EPS growth that we've seen have come from tax cuts. And so a quarter of all earnings growth for the last 40 years has been tax cuts, and that's obviously there's a limited number of times
that will make a difference.
And so we've halved it. So it's not to say that it can't go lower. And it does look like a trend at the moment. Well, this is an interesting one. So most countries around the world, this is a trend that where corporate tax rates are going lower, government stimulus is sort of based around how can we give companies even more tax credits and benefits so that even if the statutory rates don't come down, the effective rates come down. Certainly in the short term. Over the medium term, Biden's ran on a policy of increasing US tax rates. Having said that, increasing them back to the blue line, I suppose.
Yep.
The worldwide weighted average is about 28% or something, and that's roughly where he's, maybe it's a bit below 28, but he's increasing it to roughly back to there. So maybe we've reached the end of this trend. It's one, I guess, that look, from a moral perspective, you have to say, well, is it right that companies, and this adds back to that growth of the 1% that we spoke, companies do much better than workers. And that's certainly been the case for some time now. You'd probably say no, And as a sustainable demand, actually getting sustainable demand, it would be better to shift more demand, more profits out of companies' hands and back into workers' hands where they'll actually demand it rather than to save it. But I'm not convinced that this trend's changing yet. So, I want to see that. Let's see if the Biden tax cuts do get up. I suspect, unless they get Georgia next month, it's going to be difficult. But you're just looking at other countries as well around the world, the trend is very much more about tax cuts than it is about tax rises.
And I guess just using this, the obviously looking forward in the short term through this corona lens as well, it's not a great time to be increasing tax rates, is it, across the board, corporate or personal or otherwise?
No, that's right.
Pretty politically unpalatable in the middle of a pandemic.
That's right. And I do feel as if, certainly for the next year or so, it's a bit like, you're on this diet and you're saying, I'm going to try and keep myself fit and eat healthy and all that type of stuff. And then, a day comes and you have a donut or you have some chocolate or something like that. And then it's like, I've already busted the diet for today. I may as well have a Coke to go with that. And then I may as well, on to the next, on to the next. And I think that's a little bit the way governments are at the moment, is that we're seeing, some fiscal restraint. But now that you've sort of gone, there's something to blame it on. Now let's get every project we can sort of up and running. If you're a right-leaning government, then here's your chance to get some tax cuts through to corporates. And whether it's explicit tax cuts or whether it's what we've done in Australia, where there's a bunch of tax cuts for CapEx spends and all these other things, which end up being tax cuts, but they're a little bit complex, and so it's not as obvious to the average person in the street the taxes
exactly cut they are
for companies. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure. All right. Very good. And I guess just from an investment perspective, do you favour, obviously we're looking at this at a global scale, but there are, countries and, countries rather, and economies that have lower tax rates than others. And does that sort of play into, your stock selection? If you're looking at a sector, for example, and you've got a choice between a high taxing country and a lower taxing country at a corporate level, was that sort of something that you'd be
look at the factors a little bit into our assessment? So we'll look at things on a bunch of different ratios, pre and post tax, to try and sort of normalize some of these factors. And that's certainly right. You do see things show up where, say it's a tech company where you can clearly see that let's say we're looking at Apple. We decompose Apple's sort of last 10 years of earnings growth and have a look at where it comes from. And basically you go, most of it comes from sales, which is a good thing. They've been increasing their assets, so their depreciation's been increasing, and so that's sort of taken away a little bit. And that's basically all the growth side. You don't really see much in terms of debt or anything like that. It hasn't changed much. And then you look at the margin side, and they've actually been their earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and everything like that has been shrinking. So their margins have been going down over the last few years at that higher level. But they've been improving their tax rate quite considerably over the same time period. And that's more than reversed any losses they've had in their margins. And so, as we look at these, a company like that, I guess that's how we're factoring into it, is saying, okay, well, we can factor in that you've got these benefits from, so you've improved your profit margins, but we need to have a clear vision that you've improved your profit margins because your tax has improved. And that's something which we're not going to forecast going forward. If it happens, it happens. But, it's not like you can look at these things and say, hey, what a great business because they're improving their margins on the back of tax falling every year. That's not a sustainable advantage that we want to try and find in the company. So that's certainly, as we're looking at companies, that's one thing we'll consider. And the other effect is some of the higher tax paying companies. So before the US tax cuts, that was sort of one of the factors why we were trying to get exposure to US companies, was that some of them were paying quite high levels of tax. Google and Amazon and those ones weren't one of those companies, but there were other companies, industrial companies within the US, that were paying quite high levels of tax. And so as their tax rate fell from sort of mid-30s to either low 30s or high 20s, that you can see where that made a much bigger difference to the
tailwind.
To their earnings.
Okay. Very good. Well, while we're on this global theme, we'll jump across to trend number 6, world trade.
Yes, world trade.
Not a lot of that going on at the moment. Been a rough year for world trade.
Yeah. So, this is another one of these ones where, you take a 50-year view and you can just see that, that rise in world trade over the last, 40, 50 years was very, very significant. And the effect of that on the economy, you can't understate. That's turned. So basically, since 2010, you've been, or the financial crisis, I suppose, probably a better way to look at it, 2008, you've basically been headed down. Trump is, and his tariffs are obviously not helping for it. Coronavirus is not going to help this. So, we think it's likely that you're going to start seeing this go backwards even further. And I think a lot of that is that with improvements in robotics and the supply chain issues that people have seen, and improvements in 3D printing as well, in terms of costs, there's going to be a lot more companies looking to put their production closer to where the demand is.
Yep.
And so, and China's actions more recently with Australia are probably affecting other people as well, in terms of their decisions.
Well, that's a big one, isn't it? When you get these sort of shocks at the scale we've seen in 2020, it gives people a chance to pause and reflect on how reliant they are in on certain components. That if it falls down, that the whole business could potentially fall down. And I think that the Chinese recent trade spat with Australia is another great example of people stop and they go, well, hang on a second, we've really hitched our wagon to one big horse, haven't we? And we need to do something about this.
Yeah, so, that's right. And so, so I think you probably will see that continue to fall, and companies that were looking to diversify their supply chains have now got much more urgency to do so. What does that mean? We're still sort of scratching around looking for companies and that will help in that whole supply chain process. We have a few, but some of the problems you find is some of the robotics companies in particular that we quite like also had quite large oil and gas exposures. And so, so we're a bit...
win on one and lose on the other.
Yeah, exactly. And so even though the oil prices come back, we still haven't seen huge levels of CapEx come out into that industry. And so so even though those companies, the headline oil companies have certainly improved, there's some companies within that are helping and some that aren't. But that's a trend which looks like it's peaked and quite possibly will head in the other direction.
So then I guess for ourselves, when we're looking at things to hold for the long term using this particular trend, is this sort of a reason to go perhaps smaller down the market cap sort of side of things, where you're not having that big globalized sort of view anymore, where they're factories all over the world pumping into the major economies, and perhaps there's an opportunity for the smaller producers. When I say small, obviously we deal in large cap stocks, so they still are very big companies, but perhaps they're more focused or they've got the ability to pivot faster to tackle this world trade issue head on.
There's some element to that. I guess it's really I guess we're not particularly focused on the size of the company. We're probably more focused on what the exposures are. So, I guess if we're looking for more niche exposures, you're probably more likely to find them in some of the smaller companies. Is right. Okay. But I guess as well, you don't get the same size of companies in these markets. So it's not, so when you look at your Googles and Facebooks and Apples and those types of ones, they are very, very big companies. And the types of companies, we sort of invest in, most companies are over $5 billion, probably over 10 for most of the companies we buy. But you know,
market capitalization, that is
market capitalization. Whereas some of these, you know, some of the big tech companies are sort of $1 trillion
market cap
plus. And so it's they're not small caps, but they are smaller than some of the
We touched on energy before, so we'll use that as a segue into our seventh trend.
So this is one of
energy costs.
I've added this probably 6 months ago. And I don't know if we've had a podcast since we added this one. I'm pretty sure we haven't. So this is one of these trends that has only really become an issue in the last couple of years. So it's one we've had an eye on for I don't know, 5 or 10 years. I've been writing stuff on this. About this whole convergence. And so I've got this chart on the left-hand side just showing the cost of solar versus the cost of coal. And you just can't even see the you can't even see the coal price move because it's so small on this chart. Is that, you know, per megawatt hour, you're talking about thousands of dollars for solar in the, back in the 70s and 80s and versus hundreds of dollars for the coal.
So
it just didn't matter. But over the last couple of years, it's all of a sudden become the most important thing. So I've got a chart on the right. And again, this, these are indicative lines. It varies depending upon where you are, what your what the solar resources are like and coal and, you know, all these other different factors. But basically, that curve has now gone below the cost of coal. And so what that means is that that puts a lid on energy prices during the day, and then you say, well, yeah, but you still need the coal because, you know, the sun doesn't shine at night and wind doesn't always blow and things like that. And you say, yes, absolutely, you need a battery. And that's the blue line I've got on the right is showing you where that same line's coming in for the battery. So if you started, I probably should show the battery line, coal, you know, solar plus battery, or an estimate of what it would be, but it's, it'll be off the top of the scale within a couple of years. You know, you won't even be back to 2005 before it probably is off the top of the scale for solar plus battery, you know, shifting. But that's your killer app, is that if you can produce energy with a solar plus battery for cheaper than what you can produce it, say through coal, then you don't have the need for coal anymore. And so this is a trend which over the next, so for the last 40, 50 years, it's been this big trend, but it's actually meant nothing to economics, but that's all changing. And this is going to be the trend for the next number of years, which is going to start driving energy costs and really just basically put a lid on energy costs for the next or for the foreseeable future.
Can't wait.
Well, and it comes back to I haven't put the slide in here, but if you look at Australia's actually got, you know, despite the fact we're the world's largest exporter of gas. We have some of the highest energy prices in the world, and we're one of the world's largest exporter of coal. So we've got all this energy, and we've got the great solar resources. We're an energy king, but we've actually got some of the most highest energy prices in the world because of, again, political choices. But the benefit. so I've taken all the pain from having these high energy prices, but the benefit is I don't think they can go much higher. And this solar, so we're going to be one of the first to benefit. Whereas in the US, where they've got a gas reservation policy and their gas prices are very, very low, they'll get they won't see this for a few years because, you know, their electricity prices are already so low that they're just not going to notice it for a number of years. But it's coming, and a lot of these trends, the solar ones, there's technological changes that's driving it, but there's also the volume side in terms of you're getting economies of scale. As you, rather than producing 1,000 units, now you're producing 10,000. You're not producing 10,000 anymore, you're producing a million. That's really driving costs down on that side as well. So it's hard to see that reversing anytime soon.
Absolutely. Oh, well, David Morgan would attest to, you know, there's a whole growing industry in making sure that that absolutely happens. So is there anyone that's keen on finding out more, feel free to pick through our library and pull out some of our energy ones. Have been great this year. So
The next slide I was wanting to show was this one, just talking about if you keep seeing solar plus battery fall for 20% per annum, Now you're at the stage where the cost of solar plus a partial battery will be cheaper than just the fuel cost of some of these coal-fired and gas-fired plants, which basically means you've got a little bit of scope in terms of coal-fired and gas-fired to last for a few years while that's not the case, because prices are capped and you can't raise your prices, but at least your people aren't economically incentivized to shut you down because the coal-fired plant already exists. It's already there's been big upfront capital and it's just the cost of running the thing. But if the trend lines keep going the way they're going, then in a few years' time, if let's say 20% for 5 years, so to 2025, if we have quite high, it's probably be a little bit later than that. Probably 2027, 2028 is more likely. But at that stage, it will be cheaper to go and build a new solar plant and stick batteries on it than what it will to just pump more coal into your existing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so that's
the new tech completely gives up the old tech.
Exactly.
Cost wise,
yeah. Yeah. So so that's where we're. It's you sort of reach the end of that in terms of in terms of where that's going. So cool. There's a similar one for driving. I won't go too much in the driving one, but that's still a little bit further away. But basically, you look at the cost of a battery plus electricity, and that's cost of electricity is much, much cheaper than the cost for oil. And the other factor is cars are like about they waste a lot of energy in terms of just heat and noise and all that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so if you're running electric cars, it's way more efficient. And so basically what it means is if you're doing about 100,000 kilometers a year, then at the moment, then basically it matches off. So it's worth getting a battery, spending the money now on the battery and then paying it off. But that figure is coming down year after year. And so it's probably at the moment for passenger cars, it's probably more likely to be the late 2020s before that sort of hits the range where somebody who's driving 15, 20,000 kilometer a year, it's worth it. It's more of a choice at the moment. Later on in this decade, it'll become a no-brainer. And if driverless cars start any sooner, then they are doing 100,000 kilometers a year, and it's a no-brainer that driverless cars are electric-based.
Kind of win. All right, very good. A couple of questions here. Have you investigated any 3D printing businesses to invest into? Is there any 3D printing businesses on the large cap radar?
We've looked at a look. There's none on the large cap radar. I've looked at a few from the investors from the idea of is this a company worth investing in? I think there's the interesting thing for some of these companies, and it goes, it's a similar argument to the solar as well, is that the technology is changing and the prices are coming down so quickly, it's very hard to know whether today's winner is going to be tomorrow's winner. And so there's this great benefit for the consumers, and you can see who the losers are going to be, is the people who are doing the old injections, and you can see the oil companies, you can see all these losers quite clearly. The winners are a bit more difficult because you just don't know whether today's one will be tomorrow's winner, and there's so much R&D being spent in this area as well. So I'm sort of trying to stick to so the broader themes of avoiding the losers, I think, is going to be the best bet in terms of these. And then the example I use for anyone who I haven't told you this one before is the examples I always use is the tech boom and sort of. In 2000, everyone's running around paying massive amounts for Lycos and Yahoo and Excite and AltaVista, all these things you've never heard of, and paying massive amounts, not because people were stupid. They knew search was going to be fantastic and was going to be the winner. They just got it. They didn't buy Google because Google wasn't even listed and didn't want to list it until a number of years after the tech boom. And so Yeah, so that's my concern with some of these solar and the 3D printing type stuff is that tomorrow the real winner might not even be listed. And actually, given how fast costs are coming down in this area as well, a lot of it's quite turning into quite commodity products as well. So yeah, there are limits in terms of those.
Well, just on that, actually, one last question here before we move on. Damien, could you please share your view on rising commodity prices? He also says, great show. Thanks to this, Damien.
Look, I'm going to save that one for another podcast. I mean, I think the short answer is there is a reflation trade going on at the moment, which is sort of driving it. And the question is it sustainable? And do we think there's real demand behind it? And I guess a lot of it all comes back to China. Is China prepared to keep knocking down apartments and putting up new ones? Because if they are, then you can see some of this demand. But I'm concerned that I guess like we're playing the commodity trade. We've got more commodities now than we've had at a long, probably at any point in time of our history. But we're not thinking of this as a long term trend that we want to own. If you look at the long term trends in commodities, it's like a flatlining patient. Like you get these sudden spikes in commodity prices over 20, 30 year, or maybe not even 10, 20 year periods, and we're in one of those at the moment. And then they go back down to these long term levels, and then they spike higher again. You go through a 10, 20 year period of just low prices, and then you get this sudden heartbeat higher where it suddenly pops up and back down again. So from a long term perspective, commodities are not a good investment. From a short term perspective, they can be excellent investments at particular times in the cycle. And we're not going to play. It's not going. The commodity stocks we own aren't going in the bottom drawer.
Yeah, gotcha. Yep, sure. Well done. So bring it together. We've had some tailwinds, headwinds, and also some neutral.
Yeah, but most of them have been tailwinds. So you see five big tailwinds, one headwind and one neutral. And looking forward, it's very different. So you've got the headwinds are your demographics, your debt, and your trade look like being headwinds. Female participation's turned at best neutral. Tax, look, I've called it a tailwind still. If Biden gets up, maybe it turns into a neutral or a headwind. But inequality and energy are your big tailwinds. So, very different investment environment to what we've seen for the last 40, 50 years. And that's going to mean that, the winners over that period are not going to be the winners over the next sort of 10, 20 years.
Sure. All right. Yeah, very good. We've got a couple of other questions here, but maybe we'll just roll through the investment outlook first, if you like, and then we can sort of finish off on a couple of questions, Damien, or if you're happy to take them now.
Let me do the investment outlook quite quickly. Because there's not a lot of difference from last week. I've got a long list of positive factors there, a long list of negative factors. I think the key negative factors, say the virus in the Northern Hemisphere, markets don't care about now. It's all about the positive side of the vaccines. There's valuation issues. The latent bankruptcies is one of the key factors. That's your key negative. It does look like government's going to keep just putting them off and just delaying and basically accept the fact there's going to be zombie companies, zombie consumers out there. They'd prefer not to deal with them anytime soon. And so that sort of leaves the positive factors sort of trumping the negative factors in the short term. So, but really keeping an eye on that latent bankruptcies and if there's any movement on that. I think there sort of seems to be in the US a few moves to sort of try and leave an incoming administration with a few problems on that front. Because you do have to deal with it sometime, and it would be better that if you're a political party, it would be better for the other side to have to deal with it and bear the pain of it. Given the mooted appointments of Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary and the Biden's general economic outlook, I would say that they'll extend as well and pretend as we're seeing elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, certainly tough to go against the tide given everything that's going on at the moment anyway. So
yeah, that's right.
couple of questions here. So we've had the 3D printing. Niche robotics companies worth investing in now, i.e. e.g. construction robotics. Thoughts?
Well, find the right one, you'll make a mozza out of it, but it's finding the right one. It's a same. There's going to be a number of out there as well that are going to tell you about all their robotics, and there's somebody sitting there with a remote control running running stuff behind it. We've seen, we've seen the Nikola, the truck company, come out basically saying, they were running their tests and basically pushing the truck downhill and telling people it was driving by itself. And I've seen Elon Musk do similar stuff with some of his solar panels, basically, showing the solar panel roof panels. But, the trials were had things plugged in at the other end. So, I guess what I'm saying is, there's going to be some great companies in that space, but there's going to be a whole bunch of shysters as well. And so, be careful.
Only early days. Yep. Okay. A couple of other ones. So water investments.
This is this question about cheap energy, isn't it? If you think energy is going to get cheaper, then does that mean that and I do think that's the case. I do think it's going to keep getting cheaper. Is that means that desalination becomes more affordable and cheaper to do?
Absolutely.
And so does that mean
your ocean, not a lot of fresh water, but
exactly,
you can turn it around pretty quickly with cheap power?
Yeah. And so does that mean that water becomes cheaper over time? Possibly. So it's not a short term one. It's not like we're going to switch on a whole bunch tomorrow. But if you're taking a 20 year view, then you might say that's a maybe your water investments, you want to try and time that a bit to make sure you're not holding on too long. So there's probably some medium term gains to be had, but but it wouldn't be putting that setting and forgetting that one.
Okay, sure. One last one I might just finish off on. The question here on, will the AUD or against the USD reach 80 cents? Been on a bit of a tear recently.
I'm going to have to get Dave back on for talk about that. Certainly, we're not betting against the Aussie dollar rising at the moment. We're certainly.
And that's on a USD weakness, though, as opposed to.
A little bit of Aussie dollar strength. Most of it's been US dollar weakness. There's a whole podcast in that. Let's save that for another day.
Okay, sure. Paul's dropped in. How is inequality a key positive factor?
Positive factor, right. So it's from a moral perspective, you'd say no, it's negative. But if you're looking at saying a company's going to make more money and higher profits, then it's a positive for the stock market. So this is the part where you're saying, and it's a medium-term negative for the stock market as well, in terms of the real problem is this demand deficit, which is people haven't, too many people getting too much of the money, or sorry, too few people getting big buckets full of money and then just saving it, not spending it, means that we don't have the demand that we could have if the money was spread around more evenly. And so why inequality is a positive there is because in the short term, though, the effect is
pushes wages up stay low.
There's lots of money thrown at companies trying to get them, lower tax rates, incentives trying to get them to get out and spend and employ more people, and so they're benefiting from those. And then you can see on the negative side, I've actually got the negative factor where the longer term inequality effects is a negative.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was having a chuckle when we were going through those tailwinds. I saw inequality there, and I was like, well, that one's shocking for humanity, and the energy one's quite positive for humanity. But anyway, that's why it works. Thanks for your time today, Damien. Fantastic to get a nice update on our 7 mega trends, and obviously peel back and have a look through how they've gone, and also how they're going to affect us in the next couple of years as well. So thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
All good. All right. Well, in interest of time, we'll wrap her up, but I will just quickly drop in our viewer question of the week. What is your biggest mega trend for 2021? Feel free to drop it in the YouTube chat box. If you have, you can select obviously from one of ours, or if you've got one in mind yourself, feel free to drop that one in as well. Coming up next week, we have our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen, joining us fresh back from sunny Queensland to share his thoughts on the outlook for Australian property and the Australian economy in general in 2021. He's recently done some great work for the Macro Business Christmas Report, obviously, that he writes with, the Macro Business blog, including an in-depth look at the five major Australian property markets. And I'll warn you, he's actually pretty bullish. So tune in next week, Thursday the 17th of December, 12:30 p.m. for a live chat with Leith and the gang. And of course, head over to our YouTube channel, Nucleus Investment Insights, to ask questions along the way. So thanks again to all of those who've watched in live for another great episode, and to all of those who've asked some terrific questions today as well. I hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. And if you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date with news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you at the next one.